He is, in my opinion, one of the most astute political commentators I know, and an all-around cool guy. Co-author of the books Game Change in 2010 and Double Down in 2013, and staff writer for New York, Wired, and The Economist magazines. Co-producer and co-host of Showtime's The Circus. Frequent commentator on MS Now, and perhaps the coolest thing of all, one of the members of the voting body of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. John Heilman, welcome to WBGO.
Man, Jay Johnson, I'm thrilled to be here, and it's this time of year. I just happened to be doing the show right when the nominees came out for the Rock Hall, and I'm facing the difficult choices of trying to narrow down a large list down to seven choices. And it's always the first four or five, they're in the bag for me. But then I like you get you're on the bubble, and you got to really figure out who you're going to get into
Okay.
that those last coveted spots.
So are people allowed to lobby you for this?
Oh God, I get lobbied all the time. You can't imagine. I used to post the ballots on social media and ask for people's opinions. And the number of people in the music business or people who are associated with the acts who would reach out. And I mean, it's 1,200 people. The fans collectively around the world all get
Right.
one vote. They all go online and they register. They get one vote. And then there's 1,200 members of the voting body. And so, with seven to pick from. There's a bunch. You look at the list and you
No
go,
ranked
okay, these
choice
people,
voting,
there's
huh?
no ranked choice voting. It used to be that they would, it used to be smaller. It used to be you only had five. And then they went to seven, but you didn't have to use all seven. Now it's like you got to vote all seven. You got to fill all your slots or your ballot is disqualified. So it's like, it puts a lot of pressure on.
Oh, man. And so, how does one,
I had someone from
your background?
Billy Idol is nominated this year. And I just had an email from someone in Billy Idol's camp, about 3 hours ago saying, you got to get Billy in the
Okay.
Rock Hall. I'm like, I don't want to reply to that because that's not going to happen, at least not on my ballot.
So, how does one get selected for this honor of being a voting member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Well,
How do they find you?
it's the case that for a long period of time, not anymore, but for a long period of time, there is a production company called Playtone, which is Tom Hanks's production company with his partner Gary Getzman. And Gary, who before becoming Tom's partner, worked with Jonathan Demme and made Stop Making Sense. That is like kind of the I would have quit my I would have been I would have called it quits after making Stop Making Sense. But Gary went on to become Tom's partner, and for a period of time, Playtone made the concert movie that appeared every year on HBO of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony, where the inductees would come and do their speeches and play. And because I was friends with those guys, they were the producers of the Game Change movie. I started going to Rock and Roll Hall of Fame weekends. And the best thing about them, Jay, I will tell you, was the rehearsal days. Because a lot of these groups, a lot of these people don't really play anymore. Some of them do, but you roll into town, they have Friday and half a Saturday, and then the show is on a Saturday night, and everybody gets basically 20 minutes to rehearse. And some of the most magical things I've ever seen occurred in some of these rehearsal spaces. Paul Shaffer leads the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame band. He's the only band leader that everybody trusts, and they would roll in there. And I was there the year that Ringo Starr got put in the hall, and Paul McCartney showed up and played with him, and Yoko Ono was there, which is kind of quite a thing to see the remaining what the closest thing to what's left of the Beatles were all there at the same time. I saw John Legend once roll in and have only about 5 minutes. He was so late that they couldn't actually let him rehearse on the stage. And he and Bill Withers, who you I know and
Yes.
love, Bill Withers was being inducted that year. And he and Bill Withers were in a Hyatt Hotel ballroom to a conference room to do like 15 minutes of rehearsals. And the two of them walked in there and with having never met, walked in there and played, and everyone in the room was like having a heart attack with how brilliant they were.
Different generations, totally.
Inc
Yeah.
incredible, incredible. So
Keep
yeah,
on using on me until you use me up.
after going for a few years, I made a few television pieces about like feature pieces about the inductions, and eventually the guy who runs the hall, well, Jan Wenner really runs the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but Jan Wenner and the guy who's in charge of it eventually came to me and were like, you know a lot about music and you seem to know a lot of these bands. And we're looking to kind of widen out our voting body a little bit. How'd you like to do this? I was like, oh my God, how would I like to do this?
It sounds a little bit like the station manager, Steve Williams, asking me, how would you like to have your own radio show at WBGO after
Seriously,
listening to it for 25 years?
to talk about R&B, you know?
Yeah. R&B, talk about politics, history, whatever. So in that regard, I got a big question for you that I think requires a big answer.
Can
And
I preempt you? I want to ask you one question real quick. Okay.
absolutely. Go ahead.
Here's the thing, right? So I have
Rachel Maddow did this to me. I had her on and she ended up interviewing me. Go ahead.
I have six of my slots of my seven slots are filled. Okay. One of my slots is dedicated to Lauryn Hill. Another is of course dedicated to Wu-Tang Clan. First time they've been eligible. Wu-Tang is going to be a first ballot Hall of Famer if I have to kill everyone to make sure that that happens. But here I'll give you the choice. These are the choices to fill my last slot. And I'm just going to stick with R&B-ish kind of acts, okay?
Okay.
And you can
I
tell
will
me who to
not have
vote
heard of
for.
the other ones, so go ahead.
Luther Vandross, Sade, and Mariah Carey.
Oh,
I
well.
mean, Mariah Carey's not really R&B, but like these are like not like straight down the middle rock and roll bands, obviously. But I'm leaning towards Sade, but you might be able to
Wow.
dissuade me if
For
you
me,
like
it would
Luther
come down
Vandross a lot
to
more.
Mariah Carey or Luther.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how I would come out on that. They're both among my favorites. That's a tough choice. I'm deadlocked.
Okay. Well, you're not gonna. You have no help to me. Then
Oh,
that's fine.
sorry.
I guess I'll just I'll vote for New Edition instead.
Vote your conscience,
Okay, I'll vote
John.
my
Vote
conscience.
your
That's what
conscience.
like all good Americans. We should just vote your conscience. Okay, you had a
Yeah,
big
right.
question. I'll let you ask. Go ahead. Give me the big question.
Okay, all right. So we don't talk politics explicitly on this show, but I do like to ask people about their own reflections of the state of American politics. So let me ask it this way. This is a pitch with a big windup. We have as our president today someone who is combative, divisive, and unconventional, to say the least, who looks out at members of Congress during the State of the Union, points at half the chamber, and says, "These people are crazy." Who incited an insurrection on January 6, 2021, and then pardoned the insurrectionist, who observes none of the conventional norms of our democracy, who pushes and exceeds the legal bounds of executive authority, and who quite literally has taken a wrecking ball to the White House. My question to you, John, is the American people voted for this not once, but twice. How'd that happen? What is stirring in the American electorate that led to such an unconventional choice of a president?
Well, it's Jay, that's definitely not a multiple choice or a true false question. That's a PhD dissertation there, and I probably need more than a half an hour to answer it. But I'll try to be as simplistic about it as simple as kind of succinct about it as possible.
Okay.
I would say that in the 34 years that I've been doing this, covering politics for a living, the two big stories of my adult life in politics have been the rise of populism as a force. Again, these are not things that there's not the first time we've ever had populist eras in America, but populism and polarization and the increasing polarization we see, left moving further to the left, right moving way farther to the right. And those things, I covered Pat Buchanan in 1992 and 1996. Donald Trump, almost everything Pat Buchanan argued for in those campaigns is stuff that Donald Trump made central to his political appeal. He's isolationist and xenophobic, and he wanted to build a wall. It's all the same stuff. I didn't like wanted to basically end all immigration, legal and illegal. Didn't really like Hispanic people very much. I remember I wrote a piece once called "Do You Know the Way to Ban Jose," which I thought was a pretty good title. Not my title, but a good title. And I so I've seen it. I saw all this. I've had watched this all rise. All of these forces rise. Those two forces, polarization, populism, rise over the course of my career. And I think Trump is obviously an accelerant, and he's been a catalytic force for first the destruction of the Republican Party as we knew it before he came on the scene. And also for both of those forces, the polarization force and the populism force. But you could see this nativist grievance-based, ultimately nostalgic. Make America great again. Go make America, for some people, make America white again. Go back to the 50s. Somehow there was this lost greatness, this revanchist kind of view that America in the post-war era had been the loser, which
We
is
long
the
for
mo
Leave It to Beaver.
which is one of the most bonkers things ever. I mean, people often say, you know, the increasing multiculturalism of America, the fact that we're going to be at some point in our lifetime, probably, Jay, a majority and minority country, that together with the backlash against Barack Obama, you know, fueled Trump. And I don't disagree with that, but I think there's something much deeper going on. Again, there is this view that Trump and people around him and a lot of people who admire him seem to espouse, which is this crazy view, which is like, in the post-war era, America was a loser. We lost our vital juices. We lost our greatness. And, you know, I think by any actual objective metric, America in the post-World War II era was the most extraordinarily successful, powerful, influential country in the history of humanity. America rose to, ex I mean, the extraordinary prosperity, the advancements in average achievement and wealth and health and everything else that happened in this country. We were the winners of this era, much to the dismay of some people around the world. So that kind of this somehow I want to get my country back impulse he has fed. And but I have always thought he is, I said it before, an accelerant and a catalyst. I also think he's a symptom and not a cause. I mean, he has caused a lot of mayhem and chaos, but when he rolled into the Republican Party and tried to take it over in 2015, having really never been a Republican at any point in his life, that was a party that had become hollowed out and had become, I would say, corrupted. And I don't mean that in the sense of on the take, although in some cases, yes, but more its core ideology and its core set of beliefs had become really far removed from what the base of the party, what the core of the party really animated it. And Trump was in tune with all of that. And I think, and I'll try to bring this in for a landing for you in this sense, the basic things that drive our politics now, I said populism and polarization. Polarization is like a consequence, but the populism thing is really deep. And we see it in the Jeffrey Epstein thing. Ironically, it's coming back to hunt Trump. But the notion that there is a global elite who gets away with everything, doesn't play by the same rules as you and I play by, is above the law, acts with impunity, and is doing basically nefarious stuff behind the scenes. That is widely held on the left and the right. And the right has a different set of villains, and the left has a certain different set of villains. Although, again, those villains are converging in Jeffrey Epstein. Trump tapped into that in a really profound way. And, you know, the whole I am your voice, I am your retribution, I am, even though I'm a billionaire, I'm a blue collar billionaire. You know, I'm a
Well, that's
champion, I'm your
interesting.
champion. And the resentment. And I think, you know, this, you can't talk about any of this without talking about economics and the way in which income inequality has spiraled in the past couple decades. It is just, it's a very, the notion of, I've never seen a time when I thought we were in this country closer to like open revolt against all establishments. People hate politicians, they hate CEOs, they hate Wall Street, they hate the church, they hate any establishment you can name. They think is corrupt and part of this kind of cabal. And as I say, the Epstein thing is a grotesque but vivid, and it turns out much more reality-based example of it than most of us thought.
Right. So if you're saying a lot of the ire is directed upward at the so-called Epstein class, a lot of this also centers around my immigration, doesn't it?
It
Illegal
does.
immigration.
It does. I think it's focused on the other, at least in the MAGA movement. And the other can either be people like you, brown people, black people, yellow people, taking my job, stealing my vital juices, as I said before, my prosperity, my way of life, how, you know, Leave It to Beaver America that even a lot of these people didn't live in. You know, it's like most of these people were born in the 1950s. They don't know who Horton Cleaver is. But they're angry at people for those others for stealing the jobs that they wanted, the prosperity they wanted, the traditional values that they think should obtain. And then they're also angry at those up the ladder. It's basically they're omnidirectionally angry at everyone who isn't them.
Right. So, You wrote Game Change, of course. I have a theory that Sarah Palin was a precursor to
Oh,
Donald
a hundred
Trump.
percent, 100%, 100%.
She gave a permission slip to people to express openly their biases and prejudices, right?
Palling around with terrorists, as she said about Barack Obama, famously, too much to John McCain's dismay. She, if you watch the Game Change movie, they got this in a way. I mean, we didn't even really nail it in quite the way that our collaborators of the movie did, because you see at the end, the end of the movie is her giving this speech at when she
Yep.
insisted on giving a speech on election night, and John McCain and everyone tried to stop her, and she gave this speech, which is basically proto-Trump. It's a proto-Trump speech of this kind of raw, visceral kind of resentment-driven politics, and she, just a hockey mom from Alaska. She had that. The part of her that was compelling was a lot of what the same thing that Trump was compelling. Not too bright, but felt to a lot of people super relatable, and she played the victim really well, which of course is Trump's specialty.
The two most memorable lines for me in that movie was, "Sir, you're watching too much MSNBC." And the other was, "High risk, high reward."
Yes, right. Yeah.
Which whoever the I can't remember who the bettor was.
Steve Schmidt, played by Woody Harrelson, saying that to McCain when McCain says,
Right,
what do you
exactly.
think? What do you think about picking her for the putting her on the ticket? And he says, high risk, high reward.
Right. John McCain must have known she was not qualified to be vice president.
Undoubtedly, I think he knew that, and he also desperately wanted to be president, which is what always gets these guys. Jay, what happens is that you run for president, you put yourself through everything that is involved, the most emotionally, intellectually, physically, spiritually, emotionally taxing occupation, which is not being president, although that's tough. But running for president is a
Yeah.
grueling, soul-destroying flash incinerator, combination of flash incinerator, meat grinder. And you go through all of that. And you're John McCain, you've done it twice. And you were also a prisoner of war. You went through all of that, and you get to
73
be,
years old.
you
Yeah.
finally get to be the nominee of your party. And this, I'm going to use this word in quotes, this uppity, use it intentionally, this is the way they thought of it. This uppity young black guy who had no experience, no qualifications, had no reason being there. John McCain knew the world. Barack Obama didn't know anything. Again, all on McCain's point of view. And he was getting crushed. And they had looked at Obama in Berlin and said, he's a movement, and we are on our way to getting our clocks cleaned. And McCain was like, he threw a Hail Mary, and he wanted to win more than he cared about. I would say that he cared about doing the responsible thing in that moment. He later, as it got deeper into the campaign, he saw the kind of base spirits on the nasty side of his party that Sarah Palin had unleashed. He started to regret the choice, and he started to kind of, I think about, started to reflect on whether not just the choice, but on what the choice reflected in him. And
Right.
he ended up, I think, really a lot of, if you ask me, what John McCain famously walking out on the Senate floor and doing the thumbs down on the vote to repeal Obamacare, that is John McCain, his penance. That's expiating the sin of Sarah Palin. That is, I'm not going to go out the way that I ran that campaign.
Right. So, I believe that there is a pendulum effect in American politics.
100%.
Voters elect somebody in year one. By year 8 or 9, they want something radically different from what they had
Sure.
before.
Yeah.
And if you look at history, 1960, we elected Kennedy after Eisenhower. If you look at 1976, we elected Jimmy Carter after Nixon Ford. If you look at 92, we elected Bill Clinton after Reagan Bush. And then 16 years later, we elected Obama. 24, in that track, 24 should have been a
Sure.
generation change election, but it was not. But I believe that American voters are essentially fickle, and every 16 or 8 or 4 years want something radically different from what they had before, which is one of the reasons why the longer term systemic problems we have as a nation don't get solved.
Right.
But do you ascribe to that theory, or do you think that Donald Trump is the new normal, his brand of politics?
Well, I think we already know that it may be that his brand of politics will be the dominant brand of politics in the Republican Party for a while. And I don't like to make predictions. My favorite political philosopher is Yogi Berra, who said, predictions are always difficult, especially about the future. But I do think that you're, I think you can just go even more recently. I mean, George W. Bush, reformed alcoholic, born again Christian, is the opposite of Bill Clinton. Barack Obama is the opposite of George W. Bush. You know, cool, cerebral, learned, all the rest of it.
And there's
You
nobody
get,
more different from Barack Obama than Donald Trump.
and there's right, and that people are always like, how could America elect pick Donald Trump after Barack Obama? I'm like, they picked Barack, Donald Trump because he was the polar opposite of Barack Obama. And then who's the opposite of Donald Trump? Boring Uncle Joe. You know, Joe Biden, it's not generational, but temperamentally an institutionalist, someone who believes in the Senate and believes in multilateralism and is, you know, Uncle Joe. That, you know, the not even not a firebrand, you know, kind of as a man of the United States Senate, the most boring institution in Washington. I mean, really the most boring and the most self-important institution in Washington. And then we get Trump again. So I agree that we haven't got the generational swing, but the temperamental thing. David Axelrod, my friend, co-host on Hacks on Tap and longtime source of mine before we got to be friends and hosted a podcast together. His famous formulation, which I think is so has really proven the test of time to David. One of them is that running for president is like an MRI of the soul. I think that is right. Eventually, we for all the theatrics and all the performance, you see. You get to see who this person really is because they go through all of that, and we get them. We see them so much. MRI the soul. The other thing is what Americans look for in presidential elections is not a replica but a remedy, and so the question is kind of is the a replica is what is a remedy and what is a replica? You know, and I think it's right that you're correct. You have this. 45% of the country is going to vote for a Democrat no matter what. 45% is going to vote for a Republican no matter what. And in the middle, you have these angry independents. We think of the people in the middle as being moderate. They're not moderate. They're pissed off. And this goes to the thing we were talking about before, which is all these years of income stagnation, of a sense of a gap between the elite and the ordinary people. And they vote somebody in. Barack Obama says, you know, you know, the time for change has come and you know, hope and all that stuff. And they, but within a couple of years, they're like, you know, he hasn't delivered what I thought. I thought he was going to change everything. I thought he was going to change Washington. I thought he was going to radically reform things. And it turns out the system hems him in the way the system always does. We have a system that's designed for only incremental change. And the people in the middle get Barack Obama's approval rating was never like below 41. It was never really above 44, 45.
Right. It was 57% when he left. That's when he
Yes.
was going out the door, though.
Yes. And so you get, but yes, that's right. But these people in the middle, the swing vote is not a centrist vote. It's an angry and in some ways kind of it's exactly what you described. It's the pendulum. And they very quickly decide, you know, I thought that this guy was going to, I was sick of that guy, Trump, and I thought that guy Biden is going to bring, oh, and Shep, you have to, within 6 months, it's like, Joe Biden. I'm ready to think about Trump again because gas is too expensive. Nobody wants continuity in that voter cohort, and they decide presidential elections in the, you know, 8 or 6 or 7 or 8 states that matter. It's that middle 8% that makes the difference. And so I don't know, you know, what is the remedy to Donald Trump? Is the remedy temperamentally someone who's different? Is it
Is it
someone who's really?
somebody like a Zoran Mamdani,
Is it
perhaps?
so? It is it is it? It I, you know, look, I'm too early to we can talk about Zora Mamdani, but I think, you know, you could make an argument that, you know, some, you know, bookish school teacher or a librarian, you know, from rural Maine, you know, will come along. It's the ultimate opposite of Donald Trump. You look at what Gavin Newsom's doing right now, he's getting a lot of attention, and I like Gavin Newsom, known him for a long time. I think he has a lot of talents, but. Being Donald Trump, you know, a Democratic Donald Trump, I don't know whether that's what people are going to be looking for 4 years from now. As someone who is on social media all the time and is fighting fire with fire, or you know, that's what we saw with Biden was people were tired of all that, of the tweets and all the politics in their face. They kind of were like, I want normal, I want stable. And again, like I said, a key part of the electorate very shortly got frustrated with Joe Biden, but. I don't know whether the remedy to Trump is someone really far to the left. You could argue an ideological remedy would be a Zora Mamdani, a Bernie Sanders, an AOC. If it's a temperamental remedy, the opposite, someone who is not like Trump. It might be someone who's much more kind of studious or bookish, or has a little more soft spoken. I don't know what the, but that's the question to me, is like, what is it that we're not gonna, I don't think we're gonna have another, that like Donald Trump, the Trumpiest Democrat, is going to be the Democrat that's going to end up being the Democratic nominee and maybe the next president. I think it's going to be someone who is a remedy to Trump, but I just am not sure yet. The voters will tell us. We'll see. This will unfold over
Right.
time. But that's the really the big question.
If you go to Real Clear Politics, the and you look at one of the polls they have is Donald Trump's approval rating compared with the approval ratings of Bush and Obama in their second terms. And they are remarkably consistent. It's a
Yeah.
remarkably consistent downward slope, and I think that may reflect what you were saying earlier, that voters elect somebody and then they quickly become dissatisfied with them, no matter who they are.
You don't have the shine of the new in your second term. And Trump, of course, is a different cat because there was an interregnum where he kind of where he never disappeared from our politics, but he wasn't in the Oval Office. He wasn't in our faces 24/7. So he's a little different, but it still is hard the second time around because you never have that. You never, you know, I mean, Trump did a lot of stuff in his first 100 days. I mean, it was obviously a very active period and they did a lot of things and a lot of people really hate what they did. Some people really love it, but it still wasn't like new anymore. And the shine of being new is what, that first 100 days conceit is mostly about the fact that people are like, okay, we voted for this guy. Like, let's, give him some running room. Let's see what he does. Your second term, it's never like, remember, I mean, Clinton in 97, 1997, after he won, crushed Bob Dole in 1996, it was like fundraising scandals and the Buddhist temple and Al Gore and someone in the Lincoln bedroom. It was just like, oh my God, you thought this is what we reelected this guy for? People, it's like, my
And
God. Then
impeachment too.
Monica Lewinsky in early 1998. I think, it's tough to be a two-term president. And of course, Obama, faced a lot of those same challenges when he got reelected. And the realities of trying to govern as being a really a lame duck almost from the moment you start your second term, because people are already, everybody around you is already thinking about, your days are numbered and who's going to replace Barack Obama or who's going to replace Donald Trump. The only thing that's different, the biggest thing that's different now, is that Trump has so much control over the Republican Party that he has crushed and then rebuilt in his image and turned into a kind of a cult-like thing that no one is able to even hint about running for election being in 2028 until Trump stands up at some point and says, I now formally declare I will not be attempting
He's
to
never going to do that,
stay in
is he?
office. So you've got J.D. Vance is frozen in place. Marco Rubio is frozen in place. Everybody's frozen in place because the first one to step out and start raising money or doing stump, just speaking on the hustings, Trump will cut their off. You're just trying to take some of the attention away from me. So they're all kind of waiting and they're frozen, like, bugs in amber, like waiting for Trump to finally give them the high sign. I don't think it's ever going to come.
John, that going back to that swing vote in the middle, isn't in today's politics, isn't it more about culture than political ideology?
Well, I think that it's, I rarely found myself ever saying that I thought Andrew Breitbart, the late Andrew Breitbart, ever said a lot of things that were wise. But he is, I believe, the first person who ever said the thing about how politics is now downstream from culture. And I think that's right. I had a conversation with Obama about this a few years ago, over lunch in a private lunch. And we both were talking about it. He's like, it is our politics, culture drives everything now. And culture is partly a function of economics and a function of geography. Where do you live? Who do you go to school? Like, what's your proximity? Your education level? Where do you live? Where do you go to eat? What's the cultural milieu you move in is way more important, certainly than policy. We never talk about policy anymore. I mean, ever, right? It's like, but really, what goes on in Washington? Go out in America. Jay, you live in Jersey. I know you come across this sometimes, but really go out in America. People just, Washington is just anathema. And the things that go on there, the debates that are going on there, it's just not, we are not, we're so far away from the debates of our youth, where it was like, well, let's have an argument about whether we should tax more or tax less. Should we have a, protectionist policy or a free trade policy? Should we
Tariff
be,
policy, right.
what should we be part of the WTO or not part of the WTO? It's like, no one in America. I mean, let's be clear. A lot of people didn't talk about it at that level of granularity ever, but it's very, the culture war is the politics is part of the culture war. It's like, and it's wrong to try to completely say they're separate. But politics is more a function of the culture war than the opposite, than the other way around now. And what team are you on? Shirts and skins, red and blue. Like, and then these people in the middle who are just kind of omnidirectionally angry and will occasionally play with the blue team and then occasionally play for the red team. But they're all their alignments. What do they watch on TV? What do they listen to? Do they listen to country? Do they listen to hip hop? Like, that tells you more about people's politics than do they believe in big government or small government? The other thing I just say, the last thing I know, we've been going on about politics for a while here. I want to just get back to Zohran Mamdani. I will say this. The left in America right now has more traction in the party, for sure. And I would say more broadly in the political discourse than it's had at any time in our lifetimes, I would say, but certainly in our recent lifetime, certainly in the 30 years, 30 some years I've been covering politics. And I think the reason for it, to go to this very point, it's not about ideology, really. You run into these guys like in the manosphere, Andrew Schultz, comedian. He was for Bernie, he was for Trump, and now he's for Zohran. Riddle me this. How does that make sense? It makes sense because
It
he
makes
thinks
sense if you view it as more of a culture thing than a political thing, in my view.
the establishment screwing us over, and I want, and the other thing is not just I want to be any establishment, but also big change. The American people sense that there we are in a moment of enormous existential change, and that's globalization and AI and the breakdown of the party system and all of this stuff that they can barely get their heads around. And Trump offered a big answer. Make America great again is a big idea. It's like it's you might want to run it down, but it was all the stuff we said before. I want to take America back to the 50s. I want to make America, go back to a more racially homogenous and a more fortress America point of view, all that stuff. But it's like he was like the country's in terminal decline, and I am going to do stuff way outside the box. I'm going to break all these rules because it's what's required to save the country. And Democrats are like arguing about like,
American carnage, right?
right. And Democrats, by and large, a lot of friends of mine, well-meaning policy wonks, arguing about like what's the right way to get more affordable housing built. It's like, there are these very incrementalist arguments, and the left is not like that. Zohran Mamdani, and Bernie Sanders and AOC, they are the only part of the Democratic Party that is proposing solutions and ideas that a lot of people think are commensurate to the size of the challenges we face. Now, you can hate those solutions, or you can love a little bit of them. You can, whatever you stand. I'm not making a judgment about whether they're good or bad ideas, but they are big. Being a democratic socialist in America and wanting to have state-run grocery stores in New York City, along with all the other big things that Zohran Mamdani has proposed, that to a lot of young voters, it's like, okay, he's swinging for the fences, and somebody needs to do that. And I think that's, I don't know what that will mean, whether it means we're going to have an AOC nominee or why, I don't know. I don't predict the future. But I'll tell you, that's why the left is sticky right now, because for a lot of young voters who think politics is just a bunch of guys mumbling, like with marbles in their mouths about small things and small changes, they just like, you don't get it, man. Like, AI could kill us all. We could all end up like we're in the Matrix and we're like a Energizer battery that's like supporting the rise of the robots. That somebody's got to talk about some big ideas here. And Zohran and Bernie and AOC do.
It's been my opinion for a while now. If you want the keys to success in the Democratic Party, go out and interview every single person in America who voted for both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump
I
and
totally agree.
understand why.
I totally agree. And I will say there is going to be a big reward, because there are obviously a lot of people who are turned off by the far left politics of those people I just mentioned. But there's going to be a big reward for someone who can figure out how to do a radical, big swing, centrist, reformist agenda. Political reform, financial reform, regulatory reform, tech reform, who's like, I'm swinging for the fences. I'm just not, or I'm in, not, I don't want to say centrist, but is were reform of institutions, that the
Right.
institutions are broken, we have to fix them. I
Right.
think there's a giant lane there for somebody to seize the kind of the to seize the reins of big change. Because I do think that's what people are hungry for. People are hungry on the right, they're hungry on the left, they're hungry in the middle for something that will address these giant existential challenges that
Okay.
we're looking at. Okay.
Okay.
You want to talk about music now?
Back to music. Yeah. So, and I got an expert witness here on music. Classic R&B. Who are your favorites?
Well, man, there's so many. I when you asked me this in email the other day, the first people I just, always react to the first things that jump into my mind. And I think partly this is because of the political moment we're in. I mean, I love Marvin Gaye, and I have loved Marvin Gaye in all phases of Marvin Gaye's career. It's a complicated career. He went through various permutations, but I'm with the kind of critical consensus that thinks that What's Going On is maybe the best album ever made by anybody, ever. And it feels very much of this moment. It's obviously it was animated by a different period of turmoil in America.
It's Vietnam era, but yes.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying.
But Marvin, I mean, a guy who can do What's Going On, and I've also been the guy who did Hurt, who did the kind of the definitive version of Hurt Through the Grapevine, and all
And
of
Tammy
the
Terrell, yeah.
Tammy Terrell duets. I mean, his career, and then to become like a sex god, and do sexual healing and Let's Get It On and those songs that
Yep.
were ultimate like bedroom songs. I'm a big fan of that kind of R&B and soul.
Right.
I'm a big fan of Al Green, not necessarily the latter God Squaddy Al Green, but Al Green Let's Get It On music, so to speak. I'm a big fan of Al Green.
Ooh, baby.
But I'd say Marvin Gaye is right up the top of my list. I love Sam Cooke. I love Otis Redding. Otis Redding is at the very top of my list of people that I can't go a week without listening to some Otis Redding.
I've been loving you too long to stop now.
Right. And I love those folks.
Any
Those are all
female
kind of,
vocalist?
those are all kind of your generations. I let you know. Look, I mean, we all love Diana Ross. We all love. I when I think about, I'm going to think about. I'm trying to. I'm going to give myself a list here. I tried to make a list here because I wanted to give you some of this love here. The Supremes, as a thing. Tina Turner, huge fan of Tina Turner. Tina Turner, I'm mean, huge. Aretha Franklin, of course. I mentioned Sam Cooke, Ray Charles. Let's not forget him. And I think just to bring it up to our current, a little bit more in my generation. I'm a little bit younger than you. Big fan of Janet Jackson. Big fan of Whitney Houston. Genius Chaka Khan. Mary J. Blige. I'm doing only women right now. Lauryn Hill is on my ballot for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year. And I'm an enormous fan of her. She's crazy as a loon. I mean, she's a nut, but she's super talented. And the stuff she did both as on Miss Education of Lauryn Hill and on and with the Fugees was brilliant stuff.
Strumming my pain with his fingers, singing my life with his words, killing me softly with his song.
Gave me a lot to work with for my playlist. Okay, John, thank you so much. And thank you for the terrific discussion.
So that was mostly a political discussion. Really, like you're like, yeah, come here, talk about R&B. And then we're just talking about politics the whole time. That's okay. I
That's
don't
right.
mind.
One slides into the other.
Who you've been listening, who's in your R&B and slide? You ask me, I'll ask you, like, who's like, what's the Mount Rushmore, the Jay Johnson Mount Rushmore of R&B and soul?
Ah, well,
Mount
Jerry
Rushmore
Butt.
only has four faces now. Four.
Well,
Yeah, to
you've named
12.
some of them.
Yeah,
Yeah.
okay. But go ahead.
Aretha,
Yeah.
the Supremes, the Four Tops, the Dells. Get the Dells.
Yeah.
I do like Marvin Gaye, particularly his selections that have a social message. Stevie, Sam Cooke, of course, Donny Hathaway.
I left Stevie Wonder off my list. I didn't mean to. That was just an
I could
oversight.
go on and on, but those are the artists that you hear most frequently on my show. But I'm
If
going
you,
to dedicate to you, John Heilman, a
yeah.
lot of what you mentioned here.
Okay, great. Let's do it. And yeah, dedicate it. I love it. Play a bunch of those cuts. And if you don't play a little Marvin Gaye, I'll be a little upset because, what's going on, man? That's the
No,
question.
right?
That was
We're gonna
basically your question in this entire show is like, what's going on?
That's right.
Like, what's
Maybe
going
I
on?
should rename it. Okay. Good
All right.
idea.
Good to see you, brother.
John Heilman, thank you very much.
Totally my delight.